Okay, good evening. Welcome, everybody. It's good to see you all again. Hope everybody's staying safe. I'm going to start with a question that I'm telling you now, Robin. I'm going to forget.
I'll write it down.
And please make sure to remind me because I want to come full circle. But my question is as follows. We are now, I hope, I pray that we have turned the corner in regards to this pandemic, in regards to coronavirus, COVID-19. But one thing is clear. There is no question that any person who has their eyes open about the world at large has to understand that this is getting our attention. If you are a believer in a higher power, whether you call it God or something else, this is a clear indication that this is beyond normal. This is, I know it happens every few hundred years, but the way I would perceive it, the way I do perceive it, is God is getting our attention. God has caught the attention of the world. There's no corner of this world that has not been affected by it. Every time we think we've mastered it, we think we've overcome, we figured it out, there's a curveball. Well, this from a believer's standpoint, you look up and you say, okay, God, you've gotten my attention. But here's the hard part. What's the message? Okay, God, I hear you screaming loud and clear, and you've gotten my attention. But what am I supposed to do about it? We'll come back to this. Next question. You go ahead and you read in this week's Torah portion of Vayigash. Fabulous conclusion of the story of Joseph revealing himself to his brothers, and that the whole story that has started with the sibling rivalry, with Jacob giving Yosef that coat, that special coat, that led to the jealousy, that led to the attempted murder, that it led to selling him, getting him down to Egypt, and go forward the whole story. It finally comes to its conclusion where he reveals himself and he says, understand that this was part of a much larger scheme that God had in mind. Okay. Yosef immediately then hugs his brother Benjamin. He gives him a hug. And the Torah tells us that Joseph falls on Benjamin's neck and Benjamin falls on Joseph's neck and they cry. I know we've spoken about this in the past, but in the context of what we're going to speak a little bit more, I think we're going to understand something a little bit deeper. First of all, just a simple question, and that is, you don't fall on somebody's neck to cry. You fall on their shoulder, maybe, but not their neck. It's a strange terminology. And in fact, if you read the text carefully, what it says is that Joseph fell on Benjamin's necks in plural. Okay, now we're getting weird. Okay, even if you want to understand that it has some meaning that falling on the neck and not the shoulder, but why use necks when it's for Benjamin? And when it says that Benjamin falls on Joseph, it uses it in the singular, his neck. What's up with these necks? Well, let's go a little bit further. Before we delve too deeply, let's go for a moment and take a step back. Two weeks ago, we were celebrating Hanukkah, right? Great holiday, beautiful. We spoke about certain aspects of it. But does the name bother you? The name Hanukkah, what does the word Hanukkah mean? Anybody?
Dedication,
inauguration, correct. Okay?
Yeah.
You are correct, Monroe. Ladies and gentlemen, if I was going to give you the charge, I want you to come up with the name of the holiday that is celebrated in honor of the miracle of the oil, in honor of the miracle of the military victory. Go ahead. I'll give you 30 seconds to think. Give me a name for the holiday. What would you say?
FAU can get the
Really? No ideas. Huh. Well, I'll make it easier for you. Would you have chosen the word dedication?
Inauguration? I would have chosen rededication.
Okay, rededication. You would have chosen that word?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Not me. No way, Jose. How about
I would have chosen the word miracle, but I don't know what that is in Hebrew.
Great. I would have chosen something with the word miracle, or at least, I don't know. I would have called it latke. Come up with a word that everybody can associate with oil. give me something. Dedication, rededication. Okay.
I'd have called it the victory.
A victory. Okay, I can go with that word. But Hanukkah would not have been at the top of my list. It really would not have been. So why did they choose the name Hanukkah? Yes, I know, Elian, you're right. They went ahead and they rededicated the temple. But it seems like there's got to be something more in reference to the essential nature of the holiday. So let's take a 30-second journey. What is it that the Greeks were after? Did they destroy the temple? Please answer correctly.
No, they defiled it.
They did not, correct. They did not destroy the temple. They quote-unquote defiled it.
Right? Somebody has their TV on. Turn it off or mute.
Yeah, kind of hard to hear her. Anybody? I got it. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you have the Greeks? What would they have? So they didn't destroy the temple. They quote unquote defiled it. They made it impure. Okay. Why? What is it that they were trying to impress or disagree with us on? Clearly, it wasn't the idea of having a temple building, because otherwise they would have destroyed it. So they didn't have a problem with the building.
They had a problem with us having one God and our belief system. It was so different than theirs.
Great.
They did not want us to have one God. They wanted us to have many gods.
So what is defiling the temple? Go ahead and start, start putting up posters that say, "Praise it is the gods of the world." And I'm like, man, I don't know. Form a protest,
If God, you destroy
God's lives matter. I don't know. Start a new movement. What is going into and making tame, making impure the temple? What is about that they're so fahitzed about?
Because they didn't want it to become, if you destroy it, then it becomes a monument, a place where people can congregate. It's like making some, it's like why Osama bin Laden is buried at sea, so that there isn't a place for it to become where everybody would go and mourn and be.
That's interesting, because the temple was destroyed earlier by the Babylonians and subsequently destroyed by the Romans. How many Jews have gathered around the ruins and made it into a monument? I'll give you a hint. It's less than one. That's so not our thing.
Did they want to make it not usable by defiling it so that we couldn't do?
Yes, but let's get to the heart of the matter. I'll put it very succinctly. Let's make it very simple. In the Greek philosophy, it was all about science. It was all about things that could be heard, felt, measured, tested in a laboratory, something that I can connect with, that I see its relevance. You're talking about, the Jews are talking about a concept, an abstract called God that plays a role in your life. That's way out of their league. They want to be able to touch, handle, it's got to have three dimensions to it. Something that can't be heard, that cannot be seen, measured, a feeling that you get by inspiration, by being close to godliness. They're like, what language are you talking? That doesn't make any sense to me, they would say. The Beit HaMikdash stood for that connection if I can use the terminology, of where the temple really is the bridge of connecting the spiritual realm down here in the physical realm. You know, the service, I love to talk about this. The one of the most important fundamental principles in Judaism is that Judaism is not a spectator sport. It requires action. I think I shared this story with you. I had, against my better judgment, I had a sit down with my friend who was Jewish. He had a friend who became a born again Christian, and he brought his, he really had a lot of questions. And at the end of the day, my friend Eric, his friend, I'll give him a name, Squire, just so you know, okay? Squire was totally fine with his religion, except he couldn't live with the fact that at the end of life, Eric was going straight to hell because he didn't accept Jesus. And he just couldn't, he had a hard time. So he kept asking Eric all the questions about why Judaism doesn't accept Jesus. And all the, and of course, Eric is not that well versed in all of this. He turned to me. So I fed him some answers, but it wasn't satisfactory. Bottom line is that Eric and Squire on their own decided we should have a four-way meeting. Squire's going to bring his guy. Eric's going to bring me. And the four of us are going to have a conversation as to why we don't accept Jesus. Don't ask why I said yes. Big mistake. It was a big mistake. But the point why I'm sharing this with you is that when I sat down, I said, here are the ground rules. It's a very simple way we're going to do this. We're going to be very civil and we're going to have a fair conversation. But I'm not playing the name the verse game. We're not doing that. Oh, Ezekiel 54. Uh-oh, Jeremiah 21. Yeah, I can't do that. We're not going to sit down because you're not going to accept the way I read the verse and I'm not going to accept how you read the verse. It's not going to change. But if you want to know what certain principles that we can't accept, that I can do. And that's what we did. One of the core principles is that Christianity is a religion of belief versus Judaism is a religion of action. When a Christian wakes up in the morning, ask, what must you do today? The answer, all I got out of him was, you have to live your life as Jesus would want you to live. And that's okay. That's a fine answer. But can you quantify in a list, here's what I must do today? The answer is no. Well, as a Jew, I wake up in the morning and my list is already on page 2 of what I have to do today. Not because I didn't finish it from yesterday, it's because it's a new day. I still got to do it. I got to pray. I got to put on tefillin. I got to give money. It's for tzedakah. I got a million things I got to do, and it's before 6:40 a.m. Judaism is a religion of action. It has to translate. Why? Because the fundamental concept is what we believe is that spirituality is connected to physicality. It needs to be performed in the physical world. The road to spirituality is not limited to contemplating God, thinking about God and the cosmos out in the Himalayas. That's nice for an inspiration, but that's not where it ends. That inspiration has to translate into action. That's what Judaism is based on. Therefore, the one place on earth that epitomized that connection between spirituality and physicality in the highest form was the temple in Jerusalem. That's exactly what it was. It was a physical structure where we performed offerings, libations. We did physical actions so that God's presence, the spirituality, can come rest down here in the physical world. More than any other place on earth. Yes, as Jews, we perform the mitzvot, the commandments everywhere, but it's a microcosm of what the temple really was. That was the key place. So essentially, the clash between the story of Hanukkah, between the Greeks and the Jews, was over this philosophy. It was a battle of ideals. That's really what was at the root of it. Therefore, the name Chanukah, which is representing, that's really the battle about dedicating the one place that merged and bridged physicality and spirituality. They couldn't understand it. What's the difference if I touched the oil and the toil and the oil became impure? Or it's the same oil, they would look at it. The physical properties of the oil under the microscope, whether it became pure or impure, looked exactly the same. They couldn't wrap their head around that there's a concept that you have ruined it from a spiritual perspective, because it's not something that you can examine in a laboratory. To them, it had to be something in the pure physical. Don't tell me about emerging with physical, spiritual. They couldn't do that. Therefore, the task of reconnecting the physical and the spiritual, which was most apparent in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, that is the essential nature of the holiday. Hence the name Chanukah, the dedicating back, or as you put it, Elian, the rededicating of that connection of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple.
Well, so I have a question, and I know it's not for this class. We have to do it another time. But so after the destruction of the temple, how did we get to the point of where we are today, where instead of sacrifices, we're saying prayers? And how do you make that work in terms of the spirituality and the connectedness?
So you're right. It's a much longer answer, but I'll give you the short version. There's a misconception, and that is prayer is in place of, is substituting for the offerings. That is not true. There were prayers that were offered when they brought the sacrifices. It's not something that came about afterwards. Every offering was accompanied with prayers. The point is that despite not having the physical offering, because the temple doesn't stand today, I can still utilize prayer as a means of connection. That can still be done. And it's based on a verse. The verse says, "Uneshalma parim sifatenu." In place of the cows, in place of the offerings, are our lips. Meaning the ability to speak to God, to have a conversation and utter what's deep and express, articulate what's in my heart, what's in my mind, to utter that to God. Yeah, that's on the level of what it meant to bring an offering. At the root of an offering, you really were bringing yourself. The animal was a means by which I really should be me. I'm the one who should be sacrificing myself before God. The animal is taking my place out of the kindness of God's heart and says, I'll give you more than one shot, you know, because you do it, you know, if we offer ourselves, it's one and done. Right. It doesn't have a high probability of ever doing teshuvah. It's done. Right. So the concept is that the prayers that accompanied the offerings that we use today, and it's magnified because I don't have the offering. That's the short answer. Okay. You with me, guys? Okay. Now I think what we have is the beginnings of an answer of what it is talking about connection, of where you're merging spirituality and physicality. And again, it's epitomized by the temple building. Now, fascinating. Rashi on the verse, right? The commentary Rashi on the verse about Joseph and Benjamin hugging and falling on each other's necks, right? He tells us a weird, really strange concept. You know what he says? He says that, you know what they were crying about? Not just because they hadn't seen each other in so long and they loved each other dearly, but the Torah goes out of the way to phrase it in such a way that there must have been more to that conversation, much more to that encounter between Joseph and his brother. What is it? Rashi tells us that Joseph, when he saw Benjamin, he saw a vision of the future, that the two temples were going to be destroyed, and therefore he cried. You say, whoa, time out. What has that got to do with our story? Well, you have to know a little geography, folks. The temple the great Beit HaMikdash, the temples that stood in Jerusalem, on whose territory, which one of the 12 tribes, whose territory was the temple in? Yeah, the answer is Benjamin. Except for a tiny little sliver in the middle by the altar, the Mizbeach, that had Yehuda, Judah, but another time, another place. The vast majority was in Benjamin's territory. And we know, unfortunately, the Babylonians and the Romans came along, right? And they destroyed the two temples. And Joseph, when he hugged Benjamin, he had the vision that one day there was going to be trouble and that it's going to be the destruction of the temples. Similarly, Rashi continues, that Benjamin, when he fell on Joseph's neck, he saw that the precursor to the temple, which was the Mishkan, the tabernacle, that had been built by the Jews in the desert and accompanied them into the land of Israel and was settled in a city called Shiloh, for many, many, many years prior to King David, prior to King Solomon building the first temple. That too was going to get destroyed, and that the Mishkan would also. And he was crying over Joseph's loss. Okay, it's a beautiful story. Everybody's like, wow, 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 wow. What has that got to do with falling on? Where do our sages even see this in the words of the verse? All it says simply is that Benjamin cried on Joseph's neck and Joseph cried on Benjamin's necks. Ooh, neck. Hey guys, your neck. What is your neck's function? What does it do? Does it not bridge and connect your head with your body? It's exactly what this is. This is a bridge. I know the beard covers it, but it's a bridge, right? It's a connector. And if you had to be so bold as to pick the part of your body that represents spirituality, thoughts of godliness, that's your head. And if you pick the other part of your body that represents more physicality, that's from the shoulders down. So in effect, your neck is that bridge of spirituality and physicality. And when the verse reads that Benjamin fell on Joseph's neck, that's an unusual, what do you mean neck? Oh, that means you recognize something in a future point in history that's going to act as the bridge, as the neck. Yeah, that was the tabernacle. That was in Joseph's territory, Shiloh. And when it says that Joseph fell on Benjamin's necks, yeah, because there were two temples that were destroyed in Benjamin's territory. But the concept of the neck, where the sages understood, was a symbol of the connection that was epitomized by the temple. That's exactly where it's alluded to in the verse. Now, if you're asking me, is that the simple understanding? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The simple understanding is they cried because they hadn't seen each other and they missed each other terribly. And it's true. But it doesn't analyze the text carefully if you just leave it on that superficial level. Because it just simply should have said, they cried. They hugged and they cried. I know where. I don't need the description that they fell on each other's neck. That's not necessary. But if you're analyzing the text, you have to ask those kinds of questions. Fine. But let's keep going. Let's even look at the neck itself. Let's look at the idea of, let's explore what's in your neck. What's actually in your neck?
Carotid artery.
Okay. You have your carotid artery. You also have your jugular vein.
Your voice box.
Good. What else?
Your pathway to your stomach.
There you go. I was trying to give you a hint, right?
Muscles.
Yes. Your spinal column that connects your body to your
good.
Your
brain. I'm shocked that we've left out perhaps one of the also very trachea. Critical. What?
Trachea.
For yeah, me. Your trachea, your windpipe. Hello, COVID, respiratory. Hello. Right? Right. So your basic three, really, you have your, what do you call it? Your windpipe, your food pipe, and we'll call using Sid, your blood vessels, your arteries and veins shooting, connecting your head and the rest of your body. It's fascinating because if you really break it down, what you find is the similarity between the physiological functions of the neck and what was done in the temple. What do I mean? Well, the windpipe, right? The trachea. It gives us ability to breathe. But don't forget, breathing is also the mechanism being having the air go through, Michelle, the voice box through the vocal cords is what produces sound, is producing words. If you have difficulty breathing, you can't speak. Not just you can't breathe, but because you can't breathe, you can't speak. So one of the essential natures of the temple was song, was prayer. That's associated with your trachea, right? Producing sounds of prayer and Torah study. Similarly, if you want to look at the food pipe, the gullet, if you want to be right, you've got that ability which ingests the food to strengthen the body. Well, similarly, all the offerings that were brought in the temple, the offerings on the altar, right? So to say, swallowed along, consumed by the altar, which led strength spiritually to the people. And lastly, the blood that flows from the heart to the brain and back down, it's vitalized and transported via the jugular, right, to the brain, which strengthens intellectual faculties, gives your brain the oxygen that it needs to function. Well, that was another aspect, that there was a certain vitality of life, both in terms of, like I said before, Elian, with the ability to admit that I did something wrong, right? It includes the confessing what I may have, an error I may have made, subjugating my emotions, my actions of where I'm linking my brain and my body. All three aspects of your neck acting as that bridge is exactly what went on in the temple. But not only that, let's talk about voice, being able to speak. What do you find? Well, think about this. You get a thought in your head, or you heard me say something and you're processing it. How tangible are your thoughts? Yeah, not very, right? It's not very tangible. To this day, they're still trying to figure out medically exactly how the brain does what it does. But you hear a class or you think about it on your own and you're contemplating these most godly of thoughts, trying to understand life, trying to understand our universe and our role in all of it. And somehow you're able to take an intangible thought and express it, articulate it so that someone else can understand what you're thinking. How wild is that? You're taking the most non-physical and you're expressing it purely physically with words. How do you do it? With your voice. Where? Why is your voice box located in your neck? Because that's its function, is to merge that spiritual, non-physical aspect to be able to bring it out in the physical world. The mouth is that intersection of the physical and spiritual. The tongue, even the tongue itself, is designed to reflect both. It's hidden, it's in your mouth, but when a person speaks, right, to enunciate the letters, you do have to stick your tongue out somewhat. Even the word for language, lashon, right? We call lashon hakodesh, is the Hebrew language. Lashon comes from the word lush. No, not the one you're thinking of, Monroe. No, not that kind. Lush in Hebrew means to knead, K-N-E-A-D. To knead, what does that mean? That means you're taking two ingredients and you're making them, merging them into one entity. Well, that's what speech is. Speech is taking the thought and bringing it, merging it into the physical world. And the neck, that's where it's at. This is exactly where it's at. You know, I don't know. I don't want to blow you too far away here, but in Kabbalah, in mysticism, they talk about the difference The fact that speech comes from the front, you speak this way, but we relieve ourselves in the back, going the other direction. Nothing here, the way God designed the body, everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Going forward, where the throat and the neck and the mouth this way is represented of the positive forces, and understandably, the back, the dark side, right, representing the negative forces. The front, the throat is associated with Moses. Why? Because the Talmud says that when Moshe spoke, it was almost as if God was speaking from within him. His words were so godly. The terminology that the Talmud uses is God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Midaber. You'll love this expression, that God spoke mitoch grono shel Moshe, from amidst the throat, the neck of Moses. Doesn't say from the tongue, from the mouth, from the lips, from the throat. Why? Because that's the merge point. That's exactly where it's at. Moshe represents the positive forces coming forward. Who represents the backside? None other than Pharaoh, Paro. It's not surprising that the words for the back of the neck, by the way, is called Oref. Ha-Oref means the nape, right? Is that what it's called? The back of your neck? Yeah. Yes. In Hebrew, it's called Ha-Oref. Ha-Oref. Hey, Ayin, Resh, Pei. Not surprising, those are the same letters as Pharaoh. Yeah. Because he was all about the opposite of where he was trying to sever that kind of connection. Not buying in. When Moses came to him and said, God of the Hebrews said, let my people go. He said, who? God? Never heard of him. Yeah. Turning your back. You ever heard the expression, you turn your back on someone? It's a total dismissal. Yeah, that's Pharaoh. That's the back. Okay. What's this got to do with all of us? I'll tell you why. Because we can go a little bit further. We mentioned the other week when Esau finally met up with Jacob, that fateful meeting, right? Remember we spoke about what we expected. There's two kinds of Esau. There's two kinds of challenges we face. One is the Esau we know, the Esau that comes to kill us up front, hates his brother, wants to get rid of him, the Hitlers of the world. And then you have the really nice, sweet, come here, Bubala, kind of welcome you and kill you with love, right? To welcome you into a point of where, you know, you assimilate because you've become so part of the culture. But if you recall, I told you a fascinating medrash, that when Esau met Jacob, he, quote, kissed him, and it had dots all over that word. You remember that? Do you remember what I told you? And that is he tried to bite him. Where?
On the neck.
See, I didn't want to make a big deal of it then because I was waiting for tonight. Yes, he wanted to bite him on the neck. Why? Not just because that's the most convenient part where you're leaning in.
Connection.
Right? It's because Esav wants to kill the whole concept and sever physicality and spirituality. Yeah, specifically on the neck. Yes, that's what Esav is here to do, right? It's that severing the neck, that connection of spirituality and physicality. There's a medrash that says that Pharaoh tried to kill Moses, and miraculously, his neck turned to marble, and his sword couldn't do anything.
Didn't the brother turn to stone and he broke his tooth?
Yes, teeth same idea. Why? What's so unique about stone or marble, which is a stone? Why? I'll tell you a fascinating thing. It doesn't apply today for practical purposes, but in the laws of purity and impurity, there are certain materials that are susceptible to become impure and certain ones do not.
Porous.
Porous, right? That's one, but there's also non-porous items. But natural material like stone is impervious to impurity. You can't make it impure. Okay? Metals, as opposed to metals, can become impure. Okay, trust me on that. What? Why is this so significant? Why didn't it just say that miraculously his neck became as hard as iron? Became as hard as, I don't know, pick another metal. The answer is because that means if it turned to that metal, true, you didn't get killed, but that means you can still become defiled. Damage can still be done. And there can be a break to some degree between that physical and spiritual. But if it turns to stone, to marble, you can't do anything. Number one, you can't sever it, and it doesn't, it's totally impervious to any kind of defilement or impurity. Okay. So does that answer the question, right? The question is what does this got to do with the neck? Right? Why they're crying on each other's neck? So we've answered all of that. I have just enough time to go back to my original question. And I remembered. I'm so proud of myself. My original question is we're now, unfortunately, moving into almost a year. Almost a year of COVID. And I, again, from my perspective, things in the world, certainly when they're on a global level like they are now, are not coincidences. There are clear, a message is being sent. The problem is we don't know what the message is. And it's hard because as somebody, again, and I've tried to teach this, things happen in our life. Our knee-jerk reaction has to be looking internally, not externally. It's easy to look outside and say it's that one's fault or it's because of this, but never having to do with me. That's not the Jewish perspective. The Torah perspective is when things happen in our lives, we need to look inside ourselves and see, maybe I need to correct certain behaviors. I need to correct certain actions. So when you talk about a worldwide pandemic that has affected hundreds of millions, I say billions of people, billions, it can't just be, oops, there's a virus. That's not how my brain was trained to think about life. So I'm left grappling. So I turn to my sources. I turn to my sages and I say, well, what's the message? God, you got my attention, but what are you saying? So if you think I'm going to give you the answer, I apologize and you can get your money back. But I do want to share the following. It's probably the only real original thought I had throughout this entire period. And I had it back probably April April time last year. I was asking myself this question. I had no idea how much further into this we were going to be, but I was bothered. What is God telling us? And I had this was my observation. And it will tie into what we're talking about tonight. You know, for me, the hardest holiday for me to personally connect with is Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. It's the day, it's the tragic day in which the temples were destroyed. Many unfortunate calamities have befallen the Jewish people over our history, right? This is the sad period we know as the 3 weeks in the summer that lead up to Tisha B'Av. But even though intellectually, I understand it and I get it. But emotionally, it's foreign. I never saw a temple. I don't have a frame of reference emotionally. Intellectually, I get it. I've studied enough to know that that's a tragedy and we pray for its rebuilding every day. But emotionally, to sit on the ground or to sit on a low chair and to read the words of Jeremiah the prophet about in the book of Echa, right, of Lamentations, and to read the various psalm and, you know, Lamentations that we read in the keynote, and I do it, but it's hard. I don't feel that connection. Well, I'm happy, sad, whatever word you want to use, that I finally understand it on a level that I had never before, and it's because of COVID. Why? Because let's talk about one aspect of what it means to not have a temple. You see, I understand intellectually what it means not to have it, but I can't relate to it. but now I can. Because if you understand the lesson I'm sharing with you tonight about the temple is the one place on earth where it was most apparent that there's a God in this world and that there's godliness that is able to be brought down into this world and that there's a connection between godliness, spirituality, and physicality that is epitomized by the temple. That means when the temple stood, it's no shock that miracles happened in the temple every day. That's not a shocker because that's the epitome of godliness down here on earth. I'm cool with that. But the ramifications or the corollary of that is that when there is no temple, that clarity of connection is missing. That's what it means not to have the temple. I don't know what it means, the magnificence, and I don't know what any of that means. But one thing I do know is that while the prophets were able to speak the word of God, convey the messages of God, I got none of that today. As great as the greatest scholars of our generation are, they're not prophets. They cannot honestly get up at the podium and say, hey, listen up, Jewish people. We're failing on this, this, and this, and here's what we need to correct. That's what the prophets all did. Jeremiah got up and said, you guys are serving idols. You guys are failing in here. Every prophet had a message of what it is we were to rectify. Well, where are they? They're not here today. Why? Because we don't have a temple. We don't have the mechanism, the real mechanism that's the point of connection with clarity that doesn't exist anymore. So we're stuck in a situation that we find ourselves right now. We hear God screaming our name. He has gotten our attention. Okay, God, what am I supposed to do? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me now? Hello? Right? I know there's a message, but what is it? I don't know. That's what it means not to have a temple. That's what it means. That's why I say for the first time in my life, I could connect. I can relate to Tisha B'Av for the first time. Because now I, not just intellectually, I'm feeling it. I'm feeling the loss. Because what am I supposed to tell myself? What am I supposed to share with you? People want answers. Okay, fine. God, you're sending this pandemic. I get it. Why? What am I supposed to do about it? Am I supposed to improve my Shabbos observance? Am I supposed to improve my allegiance to God? Am I supposed to improve prayer? It could be a million things. I don't know. I don't know the answer. Why? Because I don't have a temple. Because that form of connection is what's missing. That's why it hurts so much. And that's why, for the first time in years, I was able to sit down and read the story of Tisha B'Av, and it had much more meaning to me than ever before. Because of this concept. Because the neck has been severed. Our jugular vein is bleeding. It's been cut. And until we're able to rebuild the temple, it's not just because we want to go back to the way it used to be. What we really are saying is that I feel the loss. You know what's in exile? Answer this question. Who is in exile right now? Most of you will say, us. We are. And you're right. But there's something else that's in exile. God. That's also an exile. God doesn't have a home here. Thank God we have synagogues. Thank God we have Jewish homes. We have small little mini temples. But the real home, God's also in exile with us. And that's why we want to go back. We want to rebuild the temple. Not for the edifice. That's nice. It's for the connection. It's for that perfect balance of bringing spirituality into physicality. This is the message. And I think that this is what our sages were trying to impress upon us in this week's Torah portion, when it teaches us about Joseph and Benjamin crying over the loss of the temple, crying over the loss of the tabernacle in each of their territories. Mm-hmm. Why were they crying? because that's ultimately, they're trying to connect as brothers and they know it's going to be short-lived because at some point we're going to have to be separated again. The connection is severed. So this is what I think perhaps we can contemplate. I don't have any great answers, but at least it's food for thought of what it is that's referred to when we talk about the temple and its loss. This is what I think perhaps. For me, this was a new and novel understanding that I had never had before till this year. So that's my thought and I'm sticking to it. Questions?
It's more a comment. It's not a question. If you were saying, if we were talking about COVID and COVID is mostly affecting the fact that people can't breathe, then and that's how, not always, but that's sort of how what it happens. And that's connected to the neck and the breathing. And that maybe it's saying that we don't have that spirituality anymore. It's saying that there's not that connection.
The answer is yes, it might be.
I understand. I know.
No, I'm saying that you're hitting it on the head. If I were to give each one of you an opportunity to express what it could be, you'd all be right. And that's the shame. We don't know. That's what we're missing. We're missing that clarity. That's what we're really missing. The exile of the presence of godliness is what's missing. We're missing that connection. What else? Anything else?
I was going to say, I have a question not related to what you said, but related to the Parsha, I think, a little bit.
Okay.
It might be a little bit far afield, so I'm not sure if everybody needs
okay.
to
start,
but there was something in there where Jacob was sent Joseph back, or maybe, I'm not sure it's this Parsha, the story, to set up a yeshiva, basically, to set up a Torah study. And my question was, this is way before, again, Moses, what was he setting up? Like, what was the torch?
Great. That's a very good question. What Robin's referring to is that when, after Joseph reveals himself, he convinces his father, Jacob, to come down with the whole family towards Egypt because of the famine, and it would be good going forward. And they would settle in the city of Goshen. That's the name of the city. It's a suburb of Egypt proper. It's like, Baltimore County. No, just kidding. Right? It's a suburb. It's a suburb of Egypt. But you're right, Robin. Jacob sends Judah ahead to, quote unquote, establish and set up the city. The word that the Torah uses is lahorot. Now, lahorot could just mean to guide or lead. But implicit in the word is guidance and leadership as far as Torah, as far as spiritual concerns. That's where the terminology of he sent Yehuda ahead to, quote, set up a yeshiva. He wasn't setting up a formal academy of Torah study. The Torah hasn't been given yet. But it was a sense of let's make sure that where we are going to settle has all of the necessary infrastructure for a vibrant Torah-based, a Jewish community. That's what that really means. Make sure, Yehuda, that it has all the amenities for us to stay rooted to our beliefs, that there aren't going to be. Ask yourself this question, Robin. Why didn't he go down to Egypt? Pharaoh would have been more than happy to build him and give him one of the most beautiful palatial mansions in all of Egypt. He was thrilled for Jacob's family to come.
They were sheep herders.
Well, okay, that was the excuse they gave. But why didn't they just give up? Listen, Sharon, if I offer you $1 million and you don't have to worry about livelihood for the rest of your life, right? And you can come live next door, you'd give up your job in a heartbeat.
Because they couldn't set up the Jewish environment.
Yeah, because Egypt was not conducive to that kind of lifestyle, to wanting to live a Torah-based lifestyle. So they purposely said, and this is the advice Joseph gave his brothers, that when you come down and Pharaoh asks you, what do you guys do? Because he's thinking, oh, good, I'll get this one as a civil engineer. And this guy I'm going to get to build the pyramids. And this guy I'm going to get. And they're like, no, sorry, we're shepherds. Ah, shepherds, you can't even live here. Get out of here. Yeah, that's exactly why Joseph told him that. Because he didn't want them, because it wasn't conducive to those values.
Okay, so when they said they set up a yeshiva, it wasn't like the yeshiva with the Torah, with Moses.
Correct. It was that kind of teachings. Now, listen. Jacob clearly taught, I'll use the word, Torah values,
right?
What we know has been formalized in the book called the Torah. The ancestors, our patriarchs and matriarchs and their families, they lived it before it was formalized in a book. Gotcha. Make sure that the community that being set up in Goshen is conducive to that.
Because when I was studying last week, I came across that and I looked for everywhere and I couldn't come up with an answer in anything I looked at.
So. Well, you came to the right place.
Yeah, I tried to research it. Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to ask, like before, when the temple was operating, was there this clarity from God? And did it cease before it fell?
Well, there's different layers to answer that question. There was prophecy. Prophecy was clearly a divine communication, right? That for sure. But the Talmud describes that even after prophecy, there was a lower level called Ruach HaKodesh, what they call Holy Spirit, divine spirit. It was not as clear. It's again, we're going down in levels. There was Moses getting it straight from God. There's passing it down. There's prophets who got messages. There's people who got a divine inspiration. And then every now and then, you know, if you're in tune with yourself, every now and then, it's not a guarantee, but every now and then you can probably feel a certain kind of aha moment that's an inspire. And it wasn't what you were expecting. It could be that is some kind of divinely sent thought for you to have. There are those things that still happen. Prophecy as a formal institution does not exist today. But you know, the Talmud says that when a parent names and gives a Hebrew name to their child, that moment of choosing the name is a divinely inspired moment meant for that child. I know of a few situations of where the parents had agreed on a certain name, and for whatever the reason, it didn't come out that way. And they were like, I guess it's not meant to be that way. I guess it's meant the other way. There is some kind of that. So I don't remember the exact timeline as to where things stopped, but in general, while the temple stood, it was a much higher level of communication than it is today. Does that answer your question, Rod? Okay. All right. All right. If not, have a wonderful rest of the week. Stay safe. Have a good Shabbos. Question. It was not on the calendar. There was I don't know what I was thinking. I forgot that there were 5 Wednesdays in December. So next Wednesday is December 30th. And I didn't have anything on your calendar. Is everyone available? I'm happy to do it. If not, we can take a break and pick it up in January.
Home for a week.
So you all don't want it. Okay, I got it.
Good. You want to do it, we're good.
See, I told you.
I'm good.
The communication, I'm good. The communication is so unclear. Hello? Yeah, okay. So we'll meet again next Wednesday. I have to think of a topic. I didn't pick one, but we'll find something for next week at 8 o'clock. All right?
And next Tuesday.
Tuesday is on.
Tuesday and Wednesday.
And we're up to the next letter. Ayin.
Ayin.
Yes. We're almost done.
Don't say that.
Give or take 6 months. Come on. What's 6 months amongst friends? Yes. So God willing, we'll be back Tuesday night and Wednesday night next week.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
have a great
Bye, everybody.